Hello and welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, November 23rd. I'm your reader, Lori Blatchford, and our articles will be from the Sunday paper, since the Nonpareil doesn't publish on Mondays. So here's our first story. Nonprofit Impact Hill looking to give space a makeover for Giving Tuesday. Written by Emily Scheib. With Giving Tuesday coming up on December 1, Impact Hill, a nonprofit, is looking to do some renovations. Impact Hill's mission is to provide the community a safe, positive, and welcoming environment for recreational, educational, social, and cultural advancement for all, said Kelly Town, executive director for Impact Hill. The nonprofit resides in the former Riverside High School building in Oakland, but they want to make it look less like a former high school by painting the walls. On December 1st, Impact Hill will have painting opportunities indoors. Some work will use a ladder and some won't. Quote, the space understandably looks like a former high school, Town said. We would love for it to have a little more of our personality and character, but need a good starting point, end quote. A majority of the walls now are two or three colors, Town said. She said she would love to see only two colors on the walls for now. There are thousands of square feet throughout the building to be painted, but right now the focus is on the common areas. Quote, classrooms we can tackle down the road as we decide what goes on in each, which goes in each space, she said. Donations are being accepted for the project. The nonprofit needs paintbrushes and rollers, paint trays, drop cloths and sheets, white eggshell paint, and white Kills cover-up primer. Impact Hill established a board of directors in 2017, and for the past 3 years, Impact Hills has operated solely through its many volunteers to organize, support, and sustain active public space for rural Pottawatomie County and surrounding areas, Town said. Quote, we have welcomed just over 8,400 visitors to our building's events since our inception, Town said. We have offered a variety of programming, which included summer STEM classes, adult interest classes, and youth athletics for practices and tournaments, end quote. Other events and programs at Impact Hill include family game nights once a month, a family New Year's Eve, open gyms, parents' night out, an annual father-daughter dance, a mother-son event, and more. Quote, Impact Hill has worked with other local organizations to bring agricultural programming, the Peterson Farm Brothers from Kansas, and educational opportunities like Pete the Cat author Eric Litwin, Town said. A rental fee space was created so people would have a place to celebrate birthdays, graduations, family gatherings, etc. Quote, our first year, the competitive percussion team, the Railmen, used the facilities for many hours of practice, Town said. They also performed their competition show for our community. Giving Tuesday will benefit Impact Hill as they face challenges because of COVID-19, much like other places in the area. They had 4,200 visitors last year and dropped down to 1,600 this year, most of them coming between January and March. The building is now limited to 15 people at a time. Quote, I came on board in August as executive director to look for additional funding sources and grant opportunities, Town said. Many of the grants we would love to apply for have a matching portion, so we hope to receive funds to be able to apply for those grants, end quote. Future plans for Impact Hill include adding a commercial teaching kitchen, technology center, agility course, and maker space area to work with metal, wood, and have a sewing suite, she continued. To volunteer or for more information, go to shareomaha.org/painting-dec-1. This article is called Asking for Support. Ahead of Thanksgiving, hospital leaders, staff encourage prevention actions to slow COVID-19 spread. This is by Mike Brownlee. The message from area hospitals is simple and one you've heard for months. Wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands, and avoid large gatherings. With COVID-19 hospitalizations at high levels locally and statewide, leaders and staff at CHI, Health Mercy, and Methodist Jenny Edmondson in Council Bluffs ask the public to do its part to protect not only hospital staff but the community at large. Quote, we're very grateful for the hard work of our healthcare workforce. We're very proud of all the work they are putting in to manage this pandemic. We're asking for help from our community, said Jenny Edmondson, President and CEO Steve Ballmer. Our staffs are part of this community. Their kids go to school. Their spouses go to work. We're asking the community not just to say we value healthcare workers, but to mean it. Protect them by wearing masks, socially distancing, avoiding large gatherings, follow the governor's guidelines. We're asking for the community not just to say we value healthcare workers, but to mean it, end quote. The latest round of COVID-19 mitigation guidelines from Governor Kim Reynolds include a prohibition of indoor gatherings of more than 15 people and outdoors gatherings of more than 30 people, along with the requirement that people wear a mask while indoors in public if near others for more than 15 minutes. The proclamation also instructs hospitals to reduce non-urgent and elective procedures. The new guidelines came as the novel coronavirus surges throughout the state and locally. Statewide hospitalizations have risen from around 700 on November 1st to a high-water mark of 1,527 on November 18th, before a slight decrease the past few days. The state's 14-day positivity rate has been above 20% throughout the month, while the 7-day positivity rate, tracked by Johns Hopkins University, was at 50% or higher for a full week before a slight dip in recent days. Pottawatomie County's 15-day positivity rate has been at 20% or higher since November 11th. While the state has confirmed 19 COVID-19 deaths in the county in November. On November 9th, the Council Bluffs hospitals had 37 COVID-19 patients, then the highest of the pandemic, and has hovered around that number or higher since, according to Pottawatomie County Public Health. There were 43 on Saturday. Quote, people are scared when they find out they have COVID. This is an unknown virus, Baumert said. Our nurses could be caring for a neighbor, someone they go to church with. This is real to them. They're fighting for the lives of our community members. We're asking the community to fight with us, end quote. Both Baumert and Ann Schumacher, president of Mercy Council Bluffs, said that while hospital bed availability is decreasing, the biggest strain is continuing to provide adequate staffing. Quote, the hospitalization rates are at record highs. Inpatient, ICU, ER, every day is going up from the previous day and previous week, Schumacher said. We have an adequate number of beds. The pressure point is staffing, end quote. The hospitals have filled those gaps through a variety of actions, including shifting staff to assist COVID-19 patients, training non-nurses to work screening stations to free up additional nurses, and enlisting traveling nurses. It's been an all-hands-on-deck approach, Schumacher said. Both facilities are also part of a larger health system which has provided flexibility and resources. Quote, we have been caring for COVID-19 patients since the pandemic began. We are entering our 8th month. I don't think any of us thought we would still be in this battle, said Kyle Krieg, critical care unit director at Jenny Edmondson. I've been so proud of our care teams and how everyone has worked tirelessly to care for the patients fighting this virus. We certainly aren't winning every battle, and that's the hardest part. We see a lot of survivors walk out of our hospital, which we celebrate, but also feel the pain for those who don't. Since the pandemic began, both hospitals have worked together, sharing information on what works and what doesn't in caring for coronavirus patients. Treatment has advanced since March. Schumacher noted high doses of oxygen, steroids, and antiviral drugs have proven effective so far. Baumert noted something as simple as the positioning of patients, prone versus supine, has made a difference. Quote, we're constantly evolving with the science, she said. What helps these patients do well to walk out of the hospital? As care shifts, everyone's aware of it. This is a work-together process, Baumert said. Jenny Edmondson announced Friday it would also begin using Bamlanivimab, an antibody drug shown to reduce hospitalizations in COVID-19 patients. But those are treatments once a person makes it to the hospital. Staff at both hospitals, along with Schumacher and Baumert, stress the need for renewed focus on prevention methods. This, quote, this pandemic has changed the role of healthcare workers completely. We need understanding, we need support, we need empathy, and a better understanding that it is going to take everyone's teamwork to get through this, said Danielle Doherty, an intensive care nurse at Mercy. Quote, if I can stress one thing about this virus, wear a mask. Do it for yourself, do it for others, Krieger said. Most importantly, do it for the healthcare workers in our community, end quote. Baumert said, if both parties are wearing a mask, it prevents the airborne transmission of particles. Schumacher added, "This is an airborne virus. The way it's transmitted is through the air, through your breathing, your talking. If you can limit the particles you're transmitting into the air, if you can do that, you're reducing your risk." Baumert added, it lowers the risk tremendously. It's not a fail-safe, but it lowers the risk tremendously. With Thanksgiving days away, the hospital heads expressed gratitude and talked about how this year the holidays need to look different to help reduce coronavirus transmission. Quote, "The first message is thank you," Schumacher said. "Thank you for standing with us and collaborating, facing this pandemic head-on. Now we need our community to rise to the occasion. Make this a Thanksgiving that's different than others." Baumert said, "We may be changing some traditions to stay safe, but we can still be very grateful for what we have and what we'll have next year after we get through this." The ER never stops on the front lines of the COVID spike. This is by David Hoddle of the Muscatine Journal, Dateline, Muscatine. With a 12-hour shift in front of them and a waiting room full of patients, many showing signs of being infected with COVID-19. Emergency room lead nurse Tasha Tover and Dr. Rhonda Sowards, medical director of Unity Point Trinity Muscatine Emergency Room, don the protective gear they hope will keep them safe. For over a week, traffic through the emergency room has rarely let up. While numbers have held steady, the increased need to change protective gear has doubled the time it takes medical providers to see patients. As Tovara and Sowards dress in their masks, one-use-only gloves, gowns, masks, and face shields, they remembered with precautions were necessary to stop the spread of the disease that has so far killed more than 259,000 people in the United States. Quote, "We are seeing a much more challenging time with this," Tover said, on the statewide spike in cases. "We are seeing a higher rate with this than we were in the spring. It is seeing an uptick for sure." The recent spike in COVID-19 in Iowa has made the state one of the highest areas of infection. Estimates are Iowa will see 100,000 new cases in November, and an area with one of the highest death rates. Throughout the state, the record high numbers of hospitalizations has made treating patients more difficult, with a lack of bed space throughout the state leading to longer waits for treatment. At Unity Point Muscatine, an area previously used as a waiting area has been altered to add 2 additional treatment beds to the 11 normally offered. Sowards said, "Over the past month, the acuity of patients coming to the emergency room has increased," saying that fear of COVID-19 keeps some people from coming to the hospital for care. She said, "People are seeking treatment after the disease has progressed, and they are much more ill than they would have been if it had been addressed sooner." The pair have seen COVID-19 patients running the spectrum of symptoms from the mild to the severe. Tover said children with COVID-19 seem to have very few symptoms, if any. The elderly population is affected more heavily. According to the Iowa Department of Public Health, over half of Iowans who have died of COVID-19 have been over 80, and more than 62% who have died have had a confirmed pre-existing medical condition. In treating the disease, the staff quickly learned any symptom a patient may have could indicate COVID-19. Tover said when someone comes to the emergency room with a cough or shortness of breath, COVID-19 is automatically suspected. They have learned if someone comes in with diarrhea, that person could also be a COVID-19 patient. She says any symptom may be consistent with COVID-19. The amount of staff on duty during the spike has remained the same due to illness and staffing concerns, and Tover said there are times when more staff could be used. She believes this is the same for every hospital in the U.S. right now, especially in Iowa. She said during Thanksgiving week, the schedule has been padded to allow additional workers in the emergency room at times. Quote, "There is going to be some challenges for patients, and that is why we want to be sure the right people are coming to the emergency room," Tover said. "We want to make sure sick people who have emergency conditions are coming to the emergency room instead of patients with mild symptoms that can be treated in urgent care or a care clinic that would certainly help," end quote. Sowards said consistently since the beginning of the spike, the emergency room beds are full by afternoon and there is a wait for treatment. She said one contributing factor is intensive care units throughout the state are full, meaning the patients need to stay in the emergency room longer while they are waiting for an ICU bed to open. Both medical professionals believe the reason for the spike is simply because people became too lax in their precautions. They relaxed as the state was beginning to open up, and people stopped wearing masks and social distancing. Large gatherings has also become more common. Sword said that the state was opening, the numbers of cases began to climb, and an eventual spike was not unexpected. Quote, "The holidays are coming up, and that is scary for us because we know there are those people, and we don't want to insult people who believe this is a hoax or believe it is a political thing. But the reality of it is that people are sick and people are dying," she said. "We just need to remind people to maintain social distancing, wear a mask, wash your hands, and avoid large gatherings. Just stay safe and keep others safe," end quote. With Thanksgiving coming up, Sowards and Tover hope the spike won't get worse, but in a way they believe it is inevitable. Tover said there is a lot of mental fatigue from social isolation, and she feels people want to move ahead with their normal lives. Sowards warns that there are so many asymptomatic cases, all it would take is a child to hug their elderly relative and the disease could spread. As they prepare to see patients, the emergency room workers took the time to remember why they do what they do and the thing that makes all the effort worthwhile. They thought of the patients who recover and seeing them walk out of the hospital to resume their normal lives. Quote, "The ER never stops," Sowards said. "There are people in the ward at 2 or 3 in the morning, and there are many more at 2 or 3 in the afternoon. There are up and down times, but there is always something happening here at all hours." This next article is titled, "They Live and Work in Fear. Long-Term Care Facilities Face Staff Equipment Shortages Amid Pandemic." And this is by Aaron Murphy of the Lee Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Long-term care facilities were among the hardest hit during the COVID-19 first wave of the pandemic this summer. Now with the virus spreading through Iowa, those facilities are once again bearing the brunt of the pandemic. So severe has the situation become that the state public health department has given its blessing, as a last resort in emergency situations, for long-term care workers with confirmed COVID-19 infection to provide care to patients without the virus. As of Friday night, there were COVID-19 outbreaks, defined as 3 or more confirmed cases in a facility, at more than a fourth of Iowa's roughly 440 long-term care facilities, and nearly 1,000 Iowans had died at long-term care facilities. Many nursing homes throughout the state say they are facing critical shortages of available workers and the personal protective equipment that protects those workers from the virus, like gloves, protective eyewear, gowns, and medical-grade face masks. As of mid-October, 38% of Iowa nursing homes reported having less than a one-week supply of personal protective equipment, or PPE, and 43% of state nursing homes reported being short on staff, according to survey responses nursing homes send periodically to the Federal Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. While long-term care facilities across the country have been hit hard by COVID-19, Iowa is higher than the national average for nursing home resident cases and deaths per capita and nursing home staff cases per capita, according to the federal data compiled by AARP. The state also is worse than the national average in the percentage of nursing homes that say they are short on staff and personal protective equipment for that staff. Quote, "It is serious," said Dee Finley, executive director of Iowa Caregivers, a nonprofit that works to address shortages among direct care workers like certified nurse aides and home care aides. "The people who work in these jobs, the nurses' aides, social distancing isn't really an option. You can't give someone a bath or assist someone to the toilet or help them with oral hygiene from 6 feet apart. Because of that, those workers are a little higher risk of contracting and spreading the virus. So they live in fear. They love their jobs, but they still live and work in fear now," end quote. Finley said the direct care workers had been working in difficult conditions for years before the pandemic hit in March. She said the positions are high turnover and low paying, She said the median salary for a direct care worker in Iowa is $13.80 per hour. Quote, they're putting their lives on the line for $13.80 per hour, Finley said. Things were not good before, so you can imagine now, in the midst of a pandemic, how challenging it is for those folks on the front line and their employers. Anthony Carroll, advocacy director for the Iowa chapter of AARP, said the 38% of nursing homes with less than a one-week supply of PPE is, quote, troublingly high, end quote, particularly at the pandemic's eight-month point. Quote, we're halfway through November, and that is troubling, Carroll said. The state has a PPE stockpile, and Governor Kim Reynolds this week urged nursing homes facing shortages to request equipment from that stockpile. Reynolds' spokesman later clarified that the facility must be dealing with an outbreak before it can request PPE from the state stockpile. The spokesman said facilities not experiencing an outbreak may be considered eligible to receive PPE from the state stockpile, but those will be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. Carroll said the state should do what it can to make it easier for facilities to get the PPE they need. Quote, Iowa should streamline this process to make it easier to get PPE in the hands of long-term care facility staff and residents, Carroll said. For the sake of residents, families, and staff, Iowa needs to do whatever it takes to ensure that we no longer have over 38% of Iowa nursing homes reporting that they don't have a one-week supply of PPE, end quote. Reynolds this week also announced she is dedicating $14 million in federal funding designated for COVID-19 response efforts to help long-term care facilities with staffing and testing. When asked if the funding can also be used to purchase PPE, Reynolds referred to the state stockpile. Reynolds also noted her office and the state public health department have worked on guidance for long-term care staffing. One of the new guidelines published in the state public health department's November update said workers with a confirmed COVID-19 infection may provide direct care to patients with a suspected infection. And, quote, as a last resort in emergency staffing situations, end quote, workers with a confirmed COVID-19 infection may provide direct care to patients without an infection. Reynolds also said this week she expects to announce an initiative next week to recruit more nurses and other critical healthcare workers to come to Iowa to help bolster the state's strained workforce. The governor's spokesman said a plan to bring more healthcare resources to Iowa is being developed, but details will not be available until next week. Quote, like our hospitals, it's important that we also provide assistance to long-term care facilities at this time, and that every Iowan continues to do their part to protect the most vulnerable of our healthcare workforce, Reynolds said. Carroll and Finley both suggested Reynolds should consider deploying the Iowa National Guard to help with Iowa's overwhelmed healthcare workers, and both proposed a state registry for direct care workers, which could be used by employers to more easily find workers when faced with staffing shortages. Legislation to create a state direct care worker registry was proposed during the 2020 session of the Iowa legislature and was being considered before the pandemic hit and derailed the session. Face of the day is Amy Bloom. She has been a familiar face at Omni Dental Center for more than two decades. Bloom grew up in Manila, a small town north of the Harlan area. She attended IKM High School, which is now IKM Manning High School, and graduated in 1996. She then went to school to become a dental assistant at Iowa Western Community College. Growing up, Bloom had braces and said her dentist always took great care of her and made her comfortable. She said that inspired her to want to do the same for others. In 1999, Bloom took a job at Omni Dental, and she's been there ever since. That was back when there was only one practice, located in the Omni Center in downtown Council Bluffs. She now works as office lead in the current Council Bluffs practice at 1026 Woodbury Avenue, and there are also Omni Dental locations in Carter Lake, Oakland, and Omaha. Bloom said it's been a great experience being part of the practice's growth over the years. It's great here, she said. I'm a people person, and I love getting to know the patients one-on-one. The team that I work with is great. The doctors are fantastic. The technology that we have, just watching it grow and change over the years, has been really neat. Outside of work, Bloom stays busy keeping up with her teenage boys, Gage and Blake, who are students in the Underwood Community School District. They are aspiring motocross riders, and she enjoys traveling to different tracks with them. She also loves being outdoors, doing anything from gardening at home to camping out in nature. We have a 90th birthday today, Charles Wood. He will be celebrating his 90th birthday today. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, there are no plans for a big celebration, but he would be so pleased to receive cards at 20159 Honeysuckle Road, Council Bluffs, Iowa, 51503. Okay, moving into the opinion page. There are two letters from the editor, or there are two letters from readers, and also a political cartoon that I wanted to describe to you. It's a cornucopia with a woman with a shopping cart with a child in it, pulls up to this cornucopia, giant cornucopia, which has these signs on it. Stay home, 6 feet, curbside service, no singing, maximum occupancy, 15 persons, 2-hour limit, masks, limit 3 households, patio dining, 2020, caution. In the Your View section, these are letters from readers. We have a letter from Clarence Meldrum of Council Bluffs called Mask, M-A-S-Q-U-E, of the COVID-19 pandemic. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds is seemingly making some effort now to extract us from our coronavirus mire. The president said for months that the danger from COVID-19 was fake news, grossly exaggerated, part of a plot to thwart his reelection plans, and that no one would be talking about it after the election. His loyal apologist, the governor, dismissed coronavirus restrictions as, quote, feel-good, end quote, measures, and failed to take any substantive action, although the Center for Public Integrity reports a White House Coronavirus Task Force recommendation last summer that 18 seriously impacted states, including Iowa, should be locked down to prevent the spread of the disease. Reynolds declared her trust that Iowans would do the right thing and recommended, but did not require, wearing masks in public. Likewise, she allowed bars and gyms to remain open with minimal constraints. The election passed, people still talking about the pandemic, and Iowa is at the forefront of the contagion. The governor has now limited gatherings for social, community, business, and leisure purposes and has limited inside operations of bars and restaurants to 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Evidently, plagues only work swing shifts. Classrooms, routine office, or factory work and spiritual gatherings are not restricted. Parenthetically, he writes, apparently a virus will not spread at school, at work, or at worship. I really hope the new coronavirus rules will work out better than the governor's trust in Iowans voluntarily doing right. However, in thinking how the governor, other public officials, and the public have handled this catastrophe the last 9 months, I wonder if maybe it's time people reread Poe's Mask of Red Death to refresh their recollections about the consequences of hiding from the costs of self-conceit. The second letter is from Kim Hageman of Polk City. The title on it is Senators Grassley and Ernst Need to Step Up. Dear Senators Charles Grassley and Joni Ernst, it is time to step up and act like someone that cares about our democracy. Your comments that try to pacify Trump and his followers are only adding to the false narrative that there is a widespread fraud in the election results. By delaying Biden's security briefings and meetings with the COVID-19 response team, you are putting our democracy at risk, as well as making the country more vulnerable to foreign advisories and deaths from the virus. The transfer of power is going to happen. Shouldn't you both be helping to make the transfer as peaceful and successful rather than complacently allowing Trump to falsely claim that he really won the election? And that brings us to the midpoint of our reading today. You're listening to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, November 23rd, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Service for the Blind. Now, what's up next is today's obituaries. Michael William Angroth. Michael William Angroth, our beloved son and partner, passed away November 5th. We have lost our beloved son and partner. Traditionally, the kitchen table is where we hear stories and reminisce about a life well lived. So we, his parents, Don and Mary Ann, and Cole, his partner, would like to share our kitchen table stories with you. We intend this obituary to be a tribute to the Michael we knew and loved. Michael arrived after 24 hours of labor. Thereafter, punctuality was never his strong suit. He was cute as a button with red curls. When he was around 3, we were at Old Tucson. There was a gentleman with an ice cream cone, and Michael wanted one. So I told him to ask the man where he bought it. The next thing we know, he was back with a cone. The man had taken him to get one. Now we know what you are thinking. No one would do that now. Michael had a flair for the creative. We still have his jacket from Greece when he played Eugene in the high school play. In addition to drama, Michael also designed and sewed his own clothing creations. The family enjoyed receiving these gifts. Perhaps the place where his creative skills shined the most was in the kitchen. Michael was an outstanding cook. We were fortunate to have beef bourguignon every year for Christmas. After high school, Michael headed off to University of Iowa and never looked back. It was in Iowa City, Iowa, he met the love of his life, Cole. Theirs was a true love story. Each and every person should be as fortunate. There are so many fabulous things to say about Michael. He was always up for a new adventure, as evidenced when we went to Italy in 2015. Michael acted as our tour coordinator. He had an easygoing, genuine, caring personality and made friends throughout the years who will greatly miss him. Michael would discuss any subject with you. Perhaps this was a result of the debate team experience in high school. He always had a very interesting and positive outlook. He was an ardent Hawkeye football fan. In my mind's eye, I can still see him bouncing on the couch, cheering and shouting. The rest of us are not such fans, but we sure did enjoy watching the games with Michael. Few people are as gracious and have the ability to put a positive spin on situations as Michael did. His inner strength was witnessed as he experienced a prolonged illness and never once complained, even when he has given himself 8-hour infusions at home each day. One of his doctors told us Michael was an inspiration. He was always smiling and had a great sense of humor. The hospital staff were appreciative of his good nature and were complimentary about Michael as a patient. The nurses told me they vied to see him, see who got to take care of him. He always tried to put others at ease and brought joy to all of those who worked with him. And when asked what he learned from his illness, he replied, "I have learned how to let others help me." Michael had the capacity to find joy and happiness in the simplest things. Gracious, compassionate, intelligent, curious, joyous. There are just few of the adjectives that we would use to describe our Michael. He is greatly loved. He was preceded in death by his grandparents, Francis and Lucy Farrell, and Bill and Doris Angroth, and his brother Adam Farrell Angroth. Michael is survived by his mother, Marianne Farrell of Dakota Dunes, South Dakota, his father Don Angroth, and his wife Marilyn of Council Bluffs, and life partner Cole Orthner of Coralville, Iowa. The family will celebrate Michael's life with family and friends at a later date due to the pandemic. Memorial contributions will be made to the University of Iowa Ryan White Program, RW Patient Fund in care of Tricia Kroll, UIHC Department of Internal Medicine, 200 Hawkins Drive, Southwest, Iowa City, Iowa 52242. Patricia L. Rue, age 93, of Council Bluffs, passed away peacefully on November 19th, residing in her Amelia Place apartment in Council Bluffs. She was born May 24th, 1927, to Patrick H. and Cora Graven Gibbons in Kennard, Nebraska. She was preceded in death by her parents, her brother Patrick Bud Gibbons, and her loving husband of 43 years, William J. Rue. She's survived by her 4 children, son Mike Rue of Council Bluffs, daughter Gail Rue with Bob Pulowski of Dallas, Texas, son Bill with Vicki Rue of Council Bluffs, and Jan Rue of Minneapolis, Minnesota. She's also survived by 5 grandchildren, Yvonne and Leroux Wallace of Dallas, Texas, Blake Rue of Omaha, Angela Rue O'Toole of North Liberty, Iowa, and Janelle Rue Valla of Bellevue, Nebraska. 10 great-grandchildren and numerous nieces and nephews. Patricia graduated from Cathedral High School and attended 2 semesters at Creighton University before leaving to marry and raise a family. Later in life, Patricia worked several years at the Driver's License Bureau and Cutler Funeral Home, both in Council Bluffs. Honoring Patricia's wishes, there will be no public memorial service or visitation. Burdella May Larson Wormaker. Burdella May Wormaker passed away peacefully at 98 years, 7 months. She was preceded in death by her husband, William Henry, After 71 years of marriage, she is survived by 5 children, William, James, Karen, John, Charles, 10 grandchildren, and 8 great-grandchildren. Jennifer Ann Reed, 54, passed away on November 16th. She was preceded in death by her mother, Judith Reed Drake, survived by daughters Alexandria and Samantha Reed, father Robert Reed, sister Michelle with Tom Watts, brothers Frank with Joey Reed, Danny Reed, and Matthew with Heather Reed, nieces, nephews, and other loving family members. Private family gathering will be held at a later date. Teresa Ann Mendez, age 87, passed away on November 19th with her family by her side. Teresa was born on November 23rd, 1932, in Council Bluffs to the late Joseph and Angelina Rodriguez Mendez and graduated from Abraham Lincoln High School. Teresa worked many years for Sears and was a member of the St. Peter's Church. She was preceded in death by sisters Connie Renteria, Angie Ruiz, Lupe Roca, and her parents. Survivors include sister Manuela Mendoza and husband Leopoldo, brother Jesse Mendez, niece Rita Valdez, great-nephew Manuel Valdez, nieces Monica Burney and Christina Norris, nephew Michael Renteria, and many cousins and other family members. Visitation will be Tuesday from 5 till 8 p.m. in Christian Wake service starting at 5 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Mass of Christian burial will be Wednesday at 10 a.m. at St. Peter's Church, interment in St. Joseph Cemetery. Gerald Tyke Darvaux, age 88, of Carter Lake, Iowa, passed away at Nebraska Medicine on November 20th. He was born on April 25th, 1932, to the late Peter and Mary Majoris Darvaux in Rulo, Nebraska. Tyke proudly served his country in the United States Navy and retired from MUD. Tyke was a longtime resident of Carter Lake. He was very active in the community and was a charter member of Carter Lake Fire Department. He was a member of the Corpus Christi Our Lady of Carter Lake. In addition to his parents, he is preceded in death by his wife, Dee Darvaux, siblings Rita Metzner, Norbert Darvaux and Raymond Darvaux, and sons-in-law Brad Schuster and Terry Purcell. He's survived by his children, Vicki Lodes with Mike, Joe Devereaux with Laura, Stephanie Schuster, Lisa Purcell, and Stacy Darvaux Hope, and siblings Peter with Noreen Darvaux, Bunny Darvaux with Rita, Barb Schultz with Ronnie, Raphael Darvaux, Michael Darvaux with Barb, Joyce Hofker with Dennis, and Mary Terry. Grandchildren, great-grandchildren, nieces, nephews, cousins, and a host of other family and friends. Open visitation without family present will be held from 9 a.m. To 5 p.m. at the Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home on Tuesday. Private family services will be held with burial in Forest Lawn Cemetery. Leona Anderson, age 84, passed away on November 18th at Longview Nursing Home in Missouri Valley, Iowa. Leona was born in Council Bluffs on April 20th, 1936, to the late Clint and Florence Bostwick McMullen. She graduated from Missouri Valley High School. Leona and husband Roger operated Anderson Distributing for both the Omaha World Herald and the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. They were married September 9th, 1972. Leona loved family gatherings where she loved cooking for all her kids and grandkids. She was preceded in death by her parents, son Charlie, husband Roger in 2018, and brother Lonnie McMullen. She is survived by her children and their spouses, Barbara with Don Royal, Elvis with Val Jacobson, Linda Miller, and Lynn with Rick Barr. Stepchildren, Roger, Mike, with Dixie Anderson, Mary with Don Brzezinski, and Nancy with Richard Wilson. Nieces, nephews, siblings, Lucille with Jerry Ord, Leonard with Lois McMullen, Betty Stortenbecker, Patrick with Nancy McMullen, sister-in-law Patricia McMullen, 6 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. Visitation is today from 5 to 8 with funeral services Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. All of that is happening at Cutler O'Neill, Meyer Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. Leona will be laid to rest in Cedar Lawn Cemetery. Betty J. Pennington, age 82, of Council Bluffs, passed away at her home November 19th. Betty was born on March 25th, 1938, in Spirit Lake, Iowa, to the late Fred and Opal Natris Grobe. She graduated from Spirit Lake High School in 1956 and attended IWCC. Betty married Richard Pennington, Sr. on June 15, 1956. They were blessed with 3 sons, William, Richard, Jr., and Charles. Betty worked at Jenny Edmondson Hospital in the Food Service Department from 1990 to 2003. She was a member of Church of Christ. In addition to her parents, Betty is preceded in death by her husband, Richard Pennington, Sr., in 2016, and her brother, Fred Grobe, in 2017. She's survived by her 3 sons, William Pennington of Council Bluffs, Richard with D. Pennington of Glen Wilton, Virginia, and Charles Pennington of Council Bluffs, 7 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, and sister Kay Deerdorf of Euless, Texas. Graveside service and burial will be Wednesday at 1 p.m. in Memorial Park Cemetery. Memorial contributions are suggested to the Carter Lake, Iowa Senior Center. Deanna D. Humphrey passed away in the arms of the Father on Thursday, November 19th. She was born June 6th, 1937, to H.R. and Wilma Thomas in Clay Center, Nebraska. After graduating Auburn High School, she attended the University of Nebraska at Lincoln for 1 year. Dee earned her degree in elementary education from Peru State College. Her nearly 4 decades in the classroom began in a one-room schoolhouse in Murray, Nebraska, and continued until she retired from Lewis Central Community Schools in 1997. Dee loved her time teaching her students, and this passion inspired both her daughters to become educators. She met the love of her life while in high school and married Robert Bob Humphrey on December 22, 1956. They loved singing together in the choir, cheering on the Nebraska Cornhuskers, and sharing special times with family and friends at Ottertail Lake in Minnesota. Dee enjoyed reading, bowling, golfing, travel, and bridge. Dee was a first-time member of the First Christian Church in Council Bluffs, and in her later years, she loved singing in a special trio, the Grammys. She was a member of the Alpha Delta Kappa, PEO Kappa Delta, and the Lewis Central Foundation Scholarship Committee. Dee is survived by daughters Kim with Scotty Strickles of Council Bluffs, Lisa with Whitey Stang of Johnston, Iowa, and grandchildren Alexis with Zach Vosberg of Hampton, Iowa, Travis with Kirsten Huff of Forest, Virginia, Peyton with Jasmine Huff of Silmar, California, Mike with Megan Stang of Des Moines, and Matthew Stang of Johnston, Iowa. The family is so very appreciative of the loving caregivers at Risen Sun Christian Village and Every Step Hospice. These healthcare providers have truly been our angels. Memorials may be directed to Deaf Missions and Lewis Central Foundation Scholarship for Deanna Humphrey in care of Cutler Funeral Home. Open visitation is today from 3 to 7 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill, Meyer Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. No family will be present. Private family graveside service. Moving on to sports and lifestyle news. First up, this is what the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade will look like amid COVID-19 pandemic by Christy Karras of the Los Angeles Times. Broadway is back. Well, sort of. Organizers of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade have revealed that the Broadway ensemble of Hamilton, Jagged Little Pill, Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations, and Mean Girls will perform during this year's event as theaters across the country remain closed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Theatrical performances have long been a staple of the annual New York City celebration, which will operate differently this year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Similarly to Pasadena's New Year's Day Rose Parade, The 2020 Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade has been converted into a telecast that Americans will be able to watch from their homes. Why not showcase New York at a time when a lot of people have missed being able to participate and watch these types of performances and cultural displays? Asked the executive producer of the parade, Susan Tercero, in a recent interview with the New York Times. Here's everything you need to know about this month's made-for-TV presentation, which will be airing from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. in all time zones on November 26th on NBC. It's going to be smaller, much smaller. In order to ensure the safety of the talent and crew, the volume of this year's parade participants has been reduced by about 75%. Additionally, all participants have to be at least 18 years old, and general participants have been limited to people residing in the New York tri-state area. Instead of the typical 2.5-mile parade route through the streets of New York City, the festivities will be filmed exclusively in and around Midtown Manhattan's Herald Square. The preceding balloon inflation ceremony, which usually takes place the Wednesday before Thanksgiving outside Manhattan's Museum of Natural History, has also been canceled to avoid drawing crowds. Performers will be masked and socially distanced. Because they will be sharing the same physical space, as opposed to the patchwork Zoom approaches of other pandemic productions, all participants will be asked to wear face coverings and other personal protective equipment, when necessary, during performances shot in installments over a two-day period. Groups, such as the Broadway ensembles, will also adhere to social distancing protocols while performing. Included in this year's star-studded Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade lineup are Dolly Parton, Tori Kelly, Sophia Carson, Sebastian Yatra, Pentatonix, Patti LaBelle, Noah Cyrus, Leslie Odom Jr., Lauren Alana, Kiki Palmer, Carol G., Jordan Sparks, Jimmy Allen, Ella May, CNCO, Camille Schreier, Brett Young, B.B. Rexall, Allie Brooke, and the New York City Ballet Company. Santa Claus will also make an appearance outside 34th Street's flagship Macy's store. Marching bands have been swapped. Sets from professional marching bands as well as other local musical groups will take over this year for the traditional high school and college marching bands, which have been invited to join next year's parade instead. The 2020 Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade will feature performances from the West Point Band, the FDNY Emerald Society Pipes and Drums, the Band of the City of New York Police Department, and the Lesbian and Gay Big Apple Corps Marching Band. Yes, there will be floats. Despite the balloon inflation getting canceled, parade floats and balloons will still play a key role in the holiday event thanks to new technology designed to operate them without the help of the 80 to 100 handlers usually necessary to bring them to life. Among this year's giant flying attractions are Pikachu from Pokemon, Smokey Bear, SpongeBob SquarePants, the Nutcracker, and of course, Charlie Brown's loyal pup, Snoopy. In sports, we have write-ups for the Iowa State game. Iowa State beat Kansas State 45-0 in Ames. And Iowa beat Penn State 41-21. That was in State College, Pennsylvania. And we also had Illinois 41, Nebraska 23, and that was in Lincoln. I'll read you the Huskers story in the time we have left. Huskers give up 5 turnovers in 41-23 loss to Illinois. This is by Evan Bland of the Omaha World Herald. Dateline Lincoln. Nebraska lost a fumble on the first play of the game, and that was only the beginning of a disastrous Saturday that quickly got away from the Huskers. 1 week after a spirit-boosting victory over Penn State, NU, with a 1-3 record now, regressed in an alarming way, with a 41-23 gut-punch loss against Illinois. The offense, with redshirt freshman quarterback Luke McCaffrey making his second career start, committed 5 turnovers. The defense was hapless on third down, allowing 11 conversions on 17 tries, and most every other down as well, giving up an average of 6.4 yards per play. It all added up to a blowout loss to Illinois, 2-3, which hadn't scored more than 23 points in a game this season. The Illini's offense got a boost from the return of quarterback Brandon Peters, who'd been in COVID protocol for 21 days, and tore up the Huskers on an 18 of 25 passing for 205 yards and a touchdown. The visitors dominated possession time, 36 minutes 21 seconds to 23 minutes 39 seconds, and had more plays than Nebraska as well, 77 to 73. Quote, "I was embarrassed by our level of execution in all three phases," Scott Frost said. "I didn't think we had the juice we had last week. We didn't get as many hats on the ball. On defense, we made mistakes over and over on offense. We made mistakes on special teams. I wasn't happy with it. I didn't really see it coming. It was almost like our team thought we won one game, so we're good. That's not how it works in this league. It's not how it works in life. It's not how it works in football," end quote. McCaffrey ran 26 times for 122 yards and two touchdowns while completing 15 of 26 passes for 134 yards with three interceptions. The Big Red slipped to the bottom of the Big Ten West standings and is reevaluating itself yet again ahead of a looming Black Friday game at Iowa. The biggest early concern was Illinois effortlessly gutting Nebraska with the run. The Illini averaged 7.9 yards per carry in the first half and busted off runs of 58 and 35 yards. Nebraska linebackers were consistently walled off, either by the opponent or their teammates, from Illinois ball carriers Chase Brown and Mike Epstein, and the Husker defensive line made few pushes into the backfield. The Illini were hot from the very start, scoring less than 2 minutes into the game, thanks to a strange, controversial fumble on Nebraska's opening play. McCaffrey faked a handoff to Marvin Scott, then moved to his left on a run-pass option. Though he'd stepped beyond the line of scrimmage, McCaffrey attempted to throw a pass to a covered Wandale Robinson. The ball appeared to land a half yard ahead of where McCaffrey started his motion, but it was ruled a fumble. Officials did not review the play, and the Illini took over at the Husker 21. The Illini scored three plays later. Nebraska answered with a 12-play, 71-yard drive full of play-action passes and strong runs from Scott, who toted the ball four times for 20 yards. McCaffrey finished off the drive with a 5-yard quarterback draw to bring Nebraska into a 7-7 tie. Illinois' next drive showed its first touchdown was no fluke, though. A 9-play, 75-yard march culminated in Brown's 2-yard plunge, which was set up by a perfectly executed power play in which Brown ran behind two pulling blockers for 35 yards until he was knocked out of bounds by Nebraska cornerback Cam Taylor Britt. The newly minted Blackshirts struggled with the Illinois run game, full of misdirection and pulling linemen. The Huskers' offense, meanwhile, hurt itself with multiple drops from receivers, whiffed blocks on McCaffrey runs, and a fourth down from Illinois' 42, a bad snap from center Cameron Juergens that went high and to the right of McCaffrey's head. The quarterback scooped it up and tried to make something of the play, but threw an interception. Helped by a 15-yard personal foul on Nebraska defensive end Casey Rogers, Illinois turned that mishap into another touchdown as Peters hit receiver Josh Imatoraba for a 28-yard touchdown on third down. He'd beaten Husker corner DeCapri Boodle and caught the Peters pass on his back shoulder. Illinois led 21-7, and later in the second quarter, the Illini went 89 yards in four plays for its final touchdown of the half. Well, that brings us to the close for today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. For Monday, November 23rd, I'm your reader, Lori Blatchford. You can access recordings of today's reading at our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland, and is used today around the world, and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff, where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap, and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But, when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.